Sometimes you just want the quick facts. No opinions, no speculation. I'm Claire Thornton, an audio editor with USA Today. My team works around the clock to bring you the Five Things podcast. Every morning, me and my co-host Taylor Wilson help you know what to keep an eye out for that day. We always have a fresh mix of stories, from politics to entertainment to sports, covering all parts of the country. On Sundays, you can lean back with in-depth episodes about stories you may have heard earlier that week. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite shows and start listening to Five Things today.
Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Florida is tied with Texas for the most Capitol riot arrests. Governor Ron DeSantis and Democratic rival Nikki Fried exchange barbs at a Florida cabinet meeting, and DeSantis sends reinforcements to the border. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and those are some of the stories I'll be discussing today with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, that music means it's number time. Gentlemen, you got some numbers today. How about you, Antonio?
Yeah, gentlemen, I'm going to go with the 12 today.
And John?
Zach, I can double Antonio. My number this week is 24.
All right, and I'm right in the middle with a 21. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the arrests from the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol keep piling up, with more than 480 people facing charges so far, and Florida is tied with Texas for the most arrests at 47 each, according to a USA Today database. I picked through the database with another reporter recently to analyze Florida's role in the insurrection. We found that not only is the state tied for the most arrests, but it also has the most individuals associated with two far-right extremist groups who are facing charges stemming from January 6th. Those groups are the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. More than a quarter of those arrested from Florida were either Proud Boys or Oath Keepers. Florida is the third most populous state in the nation, so it's not really surprising that we have a lot of people who helped storm the Capitol. But the number of arrests is still disproportional to the state's population, and the number of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers arrested from Florida is even more out of proportion. That raises the question of whether the state has a problem with extremist groups and views. Antonio, groups like the Proud Boys have been pretty active in Florida in recent years. We've talked about them before. They've even participated in mainstream GOP political events. I remember a bunch of them showing up at a DeSantis rally that I was covering in Sarasota in 2018. And I saw a big group of Proud Boys at a political rally in Bradenton just a couple of months ago. And somebody invited them up on the stage in front of a crowd of, you know, between 500 and 1,000 people. So they've definitely been out there. What's your sense of whether these sort of fringe far-right groups have become more active in the state and maybe more accepted within the Florida GOP in recent years?
Well, look, man, our reporting in the past year indicates that within the Republican Party, at least, these fringe groups are no longer fringe. They are accepted and embraced. It's the traditional conservative Republican, those who worry about things like deficits and debt and the Cold War hawks of yesteryear. Those are the ones who on the GOP landscape are on the outskirts. I base that on the popularity, for example, of far writers like Congressman Matt Gaetz. Never mind the scandals around him. He and QAnon adherent and fellow Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene have been making the rounds of rallies, packing in the party and the Trump faithful. You can also base it on the embrace that far-right candidates like big-time Islamophobe Laura Loomer got from the GOP establishment when she won her congressional primary last year for a seat in Palm Beach County, which, by the way, was the same district that former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago club is in. You can also see it in the invite of the Boca Raton Regional Republican Club that invited Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio to speak at their banquet earlier this year. That despite the clearly un-American and unpatriotic role Proud Boys played in the attempt to overthrow nearly 250 years of American democracy. Now look, this is the core of the Republican Party, these more nationalist, zealous, populist figures who put great emphasis on things like culture war politics, from wishing Merry Christmas to Mr. Potato Hill disputes, et cetera, and reject the role of America in the world as they blast endless wars. There was a poll released this morning, in fact, that nationally, 20% of Trump supporters look more favorably on Russian autocratic leader Vladimir Putin, whereas only 9% of them looked favorably on President Biden. You know, the question as we reach the halfway point in the road to 2022 is whether Florida Republicans have broadened their ranks or simply consolidated into a more narrow and more compact party that is dominated by the Trump faithful. And whether here in Florida, which we have said is the Trumpiest state in America, those far-right views will win over enough non-Republicans to keep the GOP's winning streak going next year. Certainly, it was enough to carry the state in 2020, as we saw, you know, but midterm elections are different animals. Look back at 2018 and what happened there with the blue wave. And then there are those two Miami-Dade congressional seats in those purple districts that we have talked about. Those two seats, by the way, could be really critical in deciding which party wins the U.S. House next year. We don't know what redistricting will look like, but for now, those seats are in districts that are clearly centrist. That's why the current incumbents, Cuban-Americans Carlos Jimenez and Maria Elvira Salazar, have been careful to distance themselves from the far right. They both voted to boot Marjorie Taylor Greene from her House committees early this year, and then they voted in favor of the commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol last month. They, however, are often the exception in Florida, not the rule, because this state isn't just crimson, you know, isn't just red, it's crimson, and a lot of it has to do because these formerly fringe groups are really the mainstream.
And we saw, you know, Trump, has kind of flirted with some of these groups. He was asked to disavow the Proud Boys, and he said something along the lines of Proud Boys stand back and stand by, which wasn't really a disavowal. But do you really think that they're not still kind of on the fringe? I mean, you know, you don't see like mainstream candidates, you know, encouraging the Proud Boys to attend their rallies. I think that even the rally that I went to recently where they attended, you know, it was Mike Flynn and Roger Stone, which, you know, they are pretty much embraced by the GOP at this point, but they're kind of, you know, on the far right still. You don't think that the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are still kind of fringe groups?
Well, we need to draw a distinction here. You know, they are fringe groups in terms of the general population. When you clump everybody together, the entire spectrum from progressives, you know, and far left to far right, yeah, they are the fringe. But within the Republican Party, and particularly when you're looking at the primary,
the hardcore Trump base,
the hardcore base is in Florida, that is that's not fringe. That is establishment. It just depends what the measuring stick is. If we're looking at the general population, yeah, they are fringe. But within the Republican Party, they are a decisive factor, and they will be a decisive factor in primaries.
Yeah, it was really interesting for me to see how many Proud Boys were at this rally that Flynn and Roger Stone headlined, and how they were embraced, how they were brought up on stage in front of this crowd. This group that held the rally was a former sort of like they got their start doing these Trump train events in Manatee County, and it was sort of continuing this Trump group, after the election and talking about issues, continuing to try and keep the issues that are important to sort of the MAGA faithful in the spotlight. The Proud Boys were certainly, not ostracized from that event. One of the interesting things, too, looking through some of these cases in Florida, some of these arrest records, some of the court documents and the charging documents, there was quite a number of Floridians who have been charged with assaulting police officers. You know, I think there's been a bit of an effort. There's still a big debate about January 6th. And I think some Republicans have sort of downplayed it a little bit and, questioned whether it's as serious as has been portrayed. You look at some of these are not just people, a lot of them were people who kind of entered the Capitol, walked around and left. But some of them, you know, they were basically doing battle with the police. There was a guy from Naples who was arrested, who was, charged with assaulting police, and police believe that he sprayed pepper spray on a line of officers. There was a woman in the Tampa area who had a flagpole and allegedly jammed it into a police sergeant's chest until he tripped and fell over and hit his head on a statue. You know, these are some serious charges that have been brought up here. And it looks like, these Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, that they had some of the most organized effort. You know, they were planning this, encouraging people to go well before the event took place. It's also interesting when you look at this database, the vast majority of people who went are not affiliated with an extremist group. So even though, you know, the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers make up a good chunk, and still only about a quarter of the arrests from Florida are among those groups. So you have three quarters who are people who, are just extremely pro-Trump or have other views. Some of them, there was QAnon people who expressed support for QAnon, things like that. But, when you talk to experts on extremism, they say that it's worth noting that a lot of these people, were not affiliated with particular groups, and they just, found out about this on the internet or wherever and came up there, which shows sort of the fractured landscape of extremism now, and how you can't just focus on one or two particular groups, that people can come together from broad geographies and backgrounds if there's a catalyst like there was with Trump's unfounded claims of election fraud. So some interesting stuff. We have that story up on all the Gannett, Florida news sites. Check it out. There's some interesting reporting in there. Well, as the fallout from the last election continues with the Capitol riot arrest, the next election cycle already is heating up. A pair of Democrats have announced that they're running to unseat Governor Ron DeSantis, including Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who serves on the Florida cabinet with DeSantis. Having Fried and DeSantis running against each other seemed like a recipe for some contentious cabinet meetings, and that's exactly what happened this week. John, what did the opening salvo of a potential head-to-head Fried versus DeSantis matchup look like?
Yeah, well, Zach, cabinet meetings are rarely very dramatic, but this one took a turn when the agenda included a rule implementing a provision of the new anti-protest law that DeSantis demanded after the Black Lives Matter protests. The law, includes tough new penalties for damage or assaults that grow out of a protest that turns violent, and leaves a lot of that to the judgment of law enforcement. It also includes, though, a provision that is the one that sparked the dust up between Fried and DeSantis. It allows for a city commissioner, a state attorney, or a sheriff to appeal any kind of reduction in local law enforcement budgets and have that go before DeSantis and the cabinet, who could actually order the local government to increase its budget and pay for the higher law enforcement spending. This is all kind of designed by DeSantis and Republican legislators, and now backed by two Republican cabinet members, as a blowback against the defund the police talk, which frankly has not been an issue in Florida, and really is not an issue in that many other places around the country, it seems. Still, it's a political talking point for Republicans. But on this day of this cabinet meeting, Fried did most of the talking in her exchange with DeSantis. She said that the rule implementing the new law enforcement challenge was what she called part of a disturbing trend of Tallahassee bullying local governments into submission. She pointed out that DeSantis, was also being hypocritical. She quoted him from the 2018 governor's race saying, quote, "I reject the idea that government bureaucrats in a faraway capital can plan our lives better than we can plan them ourselves." She basically concluded that, here the so-called party of small government is again telling government closest to the people what they can and cannot do with their money. That kind of quieted the Republican crowd for a moment, but DeSantis came back. He didn't have a great answer, but he defended the law by warning that it was needed in case of a rogue local government, he said. He went on to say that, if your municipal government tries to defund local law enforcement, we've got your back and we are going to protect you. So they moved on, and of course the new rule was adopted with DeSantis and the Republican Attorney General Ashley Moody and Republican Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis in favor, and of course Fried opposed. The anti-protest law is being challenged in court as in federal court as a violation of free speech by a host of civil rights organizations. But the Tuesday exchange amounted to, you know, what is likely going to be the first of many public clashes between DeSantis and Fried, especially since June 1st, when she announced her candidacy to run against him next year. She joined Democrat Charlie Crist in the race for the party's nomination. But of course, you know, Crist has a little bit of a bigger name recognition, having been a former Republican governor and served two different times on the cabinet. And of course, he ran for governor as a Democrat unsuccessfully in 2014. So this is a little bit of a rewind for him. But for Fried, you know, these cabinet meetings are going to become something of a stage. It's a good opportunity for her to draw some sharp contrast with DeSantis. And so, you know, as these cabinet meetings drone on about land purchases, investment reports, and appointments to various boards, I'm thinking these meetings may now turn into, you know, must-watch events in Tallahassee, at least for the politics, if not always for the policy, which, you know, we all have to admit can sometimes get a little dull.
Yeah, I probably most Floridians aren't even really familiar with what the Florida cabinet is, but there is sort of a shared system for making some decisions. The governor isn't he doesn't have complete authority on some things. And so the cabinet meets and it has to approve, various decisions, and includes Fried, the agriculture commissioner, and Petronas, the chief financial officer, and Ashley Moody, the attorney general. And like you said, it does seem these usually are pretty, non-dramatic meetings here. But you mentioned this, John. This is Fried's opportunity, right? I mean, she has a chance here. Crist is better known. He's raising more money than her. It looked like he substantially his fundraising was substantially higher than hers in his first month being in the race. She really needs to take advantage of these opportunities, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's got that physical contrast in that, you know, she's seated two seats away from DeSantis, and they're able to, you know, exchange words pretty freely and pretty vigorously. So it gets a certain amount of media attention, for one thing, for her. And it also puts DeSantis on the spot to have some kind of response. Meanwhile, you know, Crist is kind of able to be a little bit freer maybe in campaigning around the state, though he has a day job too as a member of Congress. But I think we're going to see more of this as cabinet meetings go on. They only meet once a month, and even that is a little bit spotty in that they're largely going to take the summer off. They don't typically meet much in July and August. But again, it's a chance for her to kind of gig DeSantis. And the idea, I guess, always is that maybe he'll say something that he regrets or something.
Florida cabinet meetings could be must-see TV on the Florida Channel going forward. Well, while DeSantis was sparring with Fried, his administration was making plans to send Florida law enforcement officers to the Texas and Arizona borders, saying reinforcements are needed to deal with the flood of undocumented immigrants. John, are you surprised that DeSantis found a way to inject himself into the immigration debate, another hot button issue within the GOP right now?
No, it seems like DeSantis has his finger on the pulse of the Republican base, which really has, you know, seized on this influx of Central American migrants to the southern border. Reports of customs officials being overwhelmed with those looking to enter the country sort of coincides with a rise in drug trafficking across the border, not so much by the migrants, but rather by U.S. citizens and nationals, Mexican nationals with ties to the Mexican drug cartels. So, here's DeSantis stepping forward as the first state to respond to calls for help from the Republican governors in Texas and Arizona. Notice he's not reaching out to New Mexico, which has a Democratic governor, but also shares a border with Mexico. This whole thing gives DeSantis the opportunity to chide President Biden for what the governor called a created crisis, he said, basically created by undoing Trump's stricter border policies, although many analysts say that the border crisis, just like the increased drug trafficking, is not solely related to Biden reinstating the catch and release policies of the Obama era. But Biden is catching heat for what's going on there. And DeSantis is not one to let this opportunity pass him by to basically enhance his image and send state law enforcement agencies. These include Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Highway Patrol, even Fish and Wildlife officers, along with cooperating sheriff's departments, deputies to the border states to assist in a mostly still to be determined capacity. It's kind of interesting, though, that his predecessor as governor, now U.S. Senator Rick Scott, also a Republican with some White House aspirations of his own, so kind of sets him up as a rival to DeSantis. Scott had a couple of interviews right after DeSantis' announcement where Scott says that he thinks that the focus should be more on what can be done to stop the spread of drugs within Florida, not necessarily at the U.S. border. Meanwhile, though, for DeSantis, you know, he's been largely quiet about what has been an increase in gun violence in South Florida in recent weeks, which has ranged from a deadly shooting in Wynwood to a gunman open fire at a Publix in Palm Beach County. Dozens of people, including children, have been, you know, shot, killed, or severely injured. You have mothers in Miami that are protesting every night, I believe, trying to draw attention to the this spread of violence in Miami-Dade. But when I asked DeSantis about his lack of action this week, he turned it around and said that this should just shows how important it is for local governments to not take any steps to defund the police. The number one thing, DeSantis said, is that would increase crime is when you turn your back on law enforcement. So, you know, he doesn't directly answer, is he planning to do anything to try to stem this wave of violence right now, which is convulsing South Florida? But, you know, you got to say, though, Sean Shaw, a Democrat who ran for attorney general in 2018, unsuccessfully, he tweeted the video of the answer by DeSantis saying, this dude is on message. It's a bad message, but he's on it. So, you know, that seems like to sum up what DeSantis has been doing. The state of Florida may be on something like autopilot, but DeSantis is in full campaign mode.
Yeah, he seems to hit all the big issues that are, you know, on the nightly broadcasts of conservative media. And the border is, you know, a significant issue. I mean, Kamala Harris, the vice president, was down in Central America recently, and she told people not to come coming to the U.S. The system is not set up for that, right? And so this is a concern for Democrats and Republicans, but it's an issue that animates Republican voters more, and it's one that you know, DeSantis's predecessor and the governor Rick Scott, you know, also you know, tried to, you know, get some attention on immigration. He proposed an Arizona-style immigration law back when he was governor, and DeSantis has pushed some immigration bills when he was governor. As governor so far, he tried to crack down on so-called sanctuary cities, and he pushed something, you know, that was an e-verify measure that would require some employers to, you know, check the immigration status of their employees. And I think some people would argue that things like that, trying to stop people from hiring people, workers who are undocumented. Like, if you want to stop the flow of undocumented migrants, making sure that businesses can't hire them illegally seems like a good way to do it. But there was a report this week that e-verify law, Antonio, I mean, that it hasn't done anything. They haven't enforced anything. That there, it really is has been toothless so far. I mean, any thoughts on that in terms of, you know, whether, you know, there's the policies in place or, you know, versus the image that the governor is trying to send?
No, because look, the image is what counts. Look, this one is acting tough on the border, even though the border is far from Florida. It does play well with a lot of Florida Hispanics voters, particularly those who lean conservative. And it could help draw a wedge between Democrats still trying to get a winning message to Latinos in that very coveted electorate. And the reason is many Latinos in Florida do not sympathize with Democratic progressives' empathy and open door for people who seeking to enter the country at the border. For example, you take South Americans, you know, Argentinos and Colombianos. many of them came to the U.S. not because they crossed the border to seek amnesty. No, they waited for years in their home countries to get legal visas to enter the United States. Talk to any of them and they'll tell you how costly and difficult that was, from all the fees they had to pay to the hardship of living in limbo, at times for years waiting to get their permission to enter the United States. And they see border jumpers as disrespectful party crashers who need to wait their turn just as they did. And they resent not just the fact that these individuals are crashing the border, but they are also getting, to some extent, public assistance. Remember, those who came here on legal visas had to show they can support themselves in America. That's why the hard line on immigration at the border plays well with conservative Florida Hispanics. So it's a mistake that this, as some of folks that I saw this week commenting on it, it's a mistake to conclude the governor's just grandstanding by sending law enforcement officers to the border, you know, to play the hard right and the xenophobes, because it's also a very effective pitch to those Hispanic voters in Florida who are less than empathetic to those seeking asylum at the border. It's almost as ineffective as the socialist label.
Yeah, it's sort of like people who come and retire to Florida and then complain about people moving to Florida. There's certainly, you know, it doesn't, just because you're an immigrant doesn't mean that you're necessarily accepting of people coming in if you don't view it as a proper coming through the proper channels. And obviously the Hispanic vote is a huge one in Florida. It was huge for former President Trump expanding his margin of victory in the state. So we'll have to watch and see how the governor's actions play with that group of voters as well. Well, we'll move on to our numbers here. John, you want to tell us about yours?
Yeah, Zach, I came in with a 24, and 24 is the percentage of the population of rural Holmes County that has gotten vaccinated against COVID-19. That's about half the state level, state average. That's in the lowest level among Florida's 67 counties, according to the state's Department of Health. Now, the state percentage vaccinated is 55% for people over age 12. But in Holmes County, up on the Alabama border, it's obviously trailing that state number by a lot. Another percentage, though, that's kind of interesting when you think about the 20,000 people that live in Holmes County is 89% of Holmes County voters supported Donald Trump in last November's election. And just as Holmes now is at the bottom of the state in terms of vaccinations, it was at the top in backing Trump with the highest percentage of any county in the state. So, you know, the people of Holmes County way back then, they even organized a Trump parade thanking him on January 31st this year. That was 11 days after he was forced to leave the White House because, yes, he did lose to Joe Biden. I'm not sure if that word has really gotten through very solidly in Holmes County. But I don't know if that was mentioned in the parade that Trump is actually leaving the White House. So you got to remember, only just over 900 people in the county voted for Biden last fall. But Holmes is really a vivid example of that clear correlation between Trump and vaccine resistance. That's a trend nationwide that's been reported by news organizations. Curiously, though, in Florida, the county which currently has the highest percentage of its population vaccinated is Sumter County, where 67% have been vaccinated. Now Sumter is the oldest county in Florida, and in the 2010 census, it was the oldest in the United States. It's home of the Villages retirement community, but it also went heavily for Trump at 68%. So, you know, I don't know really what to conclude in that case. Some places really liked Trump, but the older the Floridian, it seems like, the more likely they'll have been vaccinated. The, you know, health data shows that. So in Sumter, I guess, you know, they wanted Trump, but now they also want to stay healthy, evidently.
Yeah, that's a really interesting number, John. And I think, you know, pointing to Sumter as well, like here in Sarasota County, the vaccination rate is relatively high compared to you know, else some other places, and it's a very older, very much an older county. And so I think that for older people, they even if you're conservative, you know, and you've heard some skepticism about the vaccine, it sounds to me like They've still decided that they're not going to take any chances because older people are more susceptible to COVID-19. Whereas if you have some of these more rural areas or, you know, some of the more hardcore Trump areas where the demographics maybe aren't as older, political views might be playing more of a role there, but pretty interesting to see. Antonio, how about you?
Yeah, I had 12, and that's 12 cents. There was a 12 cent increase in gasoline prices in Florida this week, as reported by the automotive group AAA. That's bad news for the state, which is dependent on low fuel prices for commuters going to work and people traveling to and through the state. In addition, there have been all kinds of price increases taking a bite out of consumer pockets. Food prices are going up, and so have lumber prices. And that's a big deal, particularly in real estate heavy Florida. And speaking of those commuters that I mentioned a minute ago, economists also say new car prices are at their highest, and that has pushed used car prices up too. There are a number of reasons why, but what consumers really want to know is how long will this last? And I spoke to a couple of economists who warned this week that we are looking at least a 6-month to 12-month cycle. Although some pointed to a Federal Reserve study this week that warned inflation could be a factor through 2024. It's only a matter of time before price spikes become a political football. And already one consumer we spoke with this week blamed the Biden administration. That would not be good news if that's a general view of folks for Democrats' hopes to win the governor's mansion and the U.S. Senate seat next year. But then again, the ongoing fight between DeSantis and the cruise lines, which is a major employer and job provider in Florida, is also a landmine for the governor. And also those two purple districts in Miami that I spoke about a little bit earlier. Point is, we talk a lot about culture war issues and immigration and the fights between the governor and Democrats on things like voting rights and a host of other issues. But remember, guys, it's the economy, stupid, and the economy remains the issue on the grassroots for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think that inflation and cost of living is a particularly salient issue in Florida, where you have a lot of retirees who are living on a fixed income. And, you know, I remember in the past, talking to retirees who were upset about their Social Security payments, their cost of living adjustments not going up. They watch that very closely, and they watch the prices really closely. If you only have so much money and that's not just retirees, it's a lot of people who haven't been getting raises and things like that. And so, inflation can eat into more of their budget, and that could become a pretty important political issue. Well, my number is 21. That's the number of GOP lawmakers who voted against a bill this week that would award congressional gold medals to the Capitol Police and others who defended the Capitol on January 6th. We talked earlier about the fallout from January 6th and all the arrests in Florida and elsewhere. The political fallout continues as well, and there are a group of Republicans who are still questioning how January 6th has been portrayed. Some of them don't seem to like that the bill awarding Capitol Police medals described January 6th as an insurrection. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the firebrand lawmaker from Georgia, told Political that she didn't think the word insurrection was a good way to describe it, and that was used in the language of this this medal bill for police. Those who voted against the measure include two Florida lawmakers, Matt Gaetz and Greg Stube, and they are probably the two most outspoken Trump supporters in Congress. Stube's dad is also a former sheriff, so it might seem surprising that he voted against giving police officers a gold medal. Stube's spokesman told me that he supports honoring individual officers who defended the Capitol, but not the Capitol Police Department itself, saying the agency had, quote, unprecedented leadership failures that, quote, put their officers, members of Congress, and the public at risk on January 6th and led to the death of an unarmed protester. That protester that Stube's office is referring to is Ashley Babbitt, who was shot and killed by police as she was climbing through a broken window in an attempt to get to the House floor. She was shot kind of right outside where police officers had barricaded the House floor out of concerns that the mob was going to overrun the house. Stube has raised questions about Babbitt's death, quizzing FBI Director Christopher Wray last week about why the FBI would investigate George Floyd's death and not
Babbitt's death. Ray said he isn't sure whether the FBI was involved in investigating the Babbitt shooting. Stubbe's vote on the Congressional Medal Bill and his questioning of Ray are both examples of how Republicans reject much of the narrative around January 6th, at least some Republicans, even as the arrests from the siege keep piling up. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy. Thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.